Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. What does it take to make a chef? Donald Link is here to share a very personal glimpse into what forces came together to mold him into one of the greatest chefs in America today. Then we'll hear from Dat Dog creator Skip Murray about what it takes to create a successful restaurant concept. Wait till you hear what the hot dog guy has up his sleeve now. And Scott Gold chimes in with the how-tos of making perfect French fries. How to make a chef, how to create a restaurant concept, and how to fry those perfect pommes frites? We'll tell you how on this week's Louisiana Eats. Call him whatever you like, brash, bold, outspoken, authoritative, or unapologetic. Donald Link is, above all else, one hell of a chef. In the past several years, he and his restaurant partners have won 5 James Beard Awards, and there's no sign their business ventures are slowing down. There's even plans to move outside Louisiana. Somehow, he even finds time to write cookbooks. His latest is called Down South. But Donald's accolades and ambitions might have been different had he not made one crucial decision while at LSU.
I had one semester left and walked out of a QBA 3000 level class, and just I'm sitting there with 200 people. I was like, I hate this. I don't want to do this for a living. I sit behind a desk and crunching numbers and working for somebody. It's like, I just walked out. I threw the books in the trash on the way out. Didn't drop the classes or anything. Just so that's it for me. Go find something else to do. And that's how it all started. You know, as usual, like through high school, I cooked in McDonald's and Cotton's Hamburgers and some Mexican restaurant. So I just went back to cooking. You know, I went back to Sammy's Bar and Grill because it was fun and the girls were pretty. Yeah. And we got to go play golf on the Sundays and drink at the Gator Bar on Sunday night. I mean, it was a great life, you know, just go fry up some veggie baskets and po' boys, make some omelets on Sunday, and then, you know, go hang out with the guys. I mean, it was just fell in love with the lifestyle, too. I mean, food was always there, and it's the lifestyle that really sold me on being a cook. And when I moved to San Francisco, I decided to make it official.
Okay, so it was culinary school. You decided, okay, well, that's where I'm going to go. I'll go study in California because, after all, there was a rock and food scene.
Not exactly like that. I met a girl at LSU. We moved to San Francisco together, and at the time, I was debating whether or not to go back to school because at that time, you know, growing up my age, it was you had to go to college or you'd be worth nothing, and there was always this pressure to do it. But, you know, the first thing I did when I got to San Francisco, I got a job cooking at Spaghetti Western. It's like a breakfast joint where all the rock stars and heroin addicts used to go. They'd come in all right, and then they'd go to the bathroom and come out and fall asleep at the breakfast counter.
That must have been a glamorous job.
It was great, yeah. But they asked me to start cooking at dinner. They found out I was from Louisiana. I'm like, we should do a Cajun thing at dinner. And so I did that for 6 months, and it was great, man. I got busy. It was an open kitchen. I met so many cool, interesting people. Really liked people I cooked with. And then they sold that restaurant, and the owners brought me to their place on the other side of Haight, Upper Haight, called Cha Cha Cha. That was a Caribbean restaurant. It was super busy, 3-hour wait, cash only. I mean, it was a really rocking place. And that was where I learned to cook fast. Like two cooks doing, 400 or 500 people a night. And I made a bunch of money. I worked 6 days a week. I mean, we got cash tips. We got overtime. I mean, it was killing it. And then it hit me at that point. I was like, okay, so is this it? Is this the end of the road? Is this where it goes? I mean, at that time, I was like, I can't imagine making any more money doing this. But, God, I can't imagine working this hard for the rest of my life. I mean, 12-hour days, 6-7 days a week.
The toll it takes on the human body.
Yeah, even at 23, it was like, man,
I'm tired.
My ass kicked. But I wanted to take it farther. You know, I wanted to see what else was out there. And being around in San Francisco, you know, you start seeing all the, you know, the big name restaurants. So I decided to go to culinary school, and that's when I started getting into the finer dining establishments. Went and worked for a crazy French guy at Flying Saucer because they said no one could work for him. When I started school, though, there was still old French chefs, you know, men, the one that used to complain about sexual harassment charges, those kind of guys. Mm-hmm. But they talked about this chef, Albert, at Flying Saucer like he was legend. Like he used to be an instructor here, and they let him go because he made everybody cry. And they said that anybody that can work for this guy will have it made for the rest of their life. So very next day, guess where I was?
At the Flying Saucer.
I want to work here.
How'd that go?
It was great. I made it. I mean, I worked there. It was terrifying the first night. He did. He screamed, hollered, threw things. You know that old story of the chef that stabs a knife in the critic's table?
Yes.
That was him. He's that guy. Like, he did that. He's the one that created that legend, that urban legend, if you want to call it that, urban myth. That was him. He actually did it. And he threw people out of the restaurant. He fired at least two people a night. But I made it, you know. I made it through the first night, and he said, great job, man. I'll see you tomorrow. And I was like, oh, I did it. That's all you got to do is get through the night.
Well, what did you learn from that experience? What was your big takeaway?
I learned how to be quiet, keep my mouth shut, and say, yes, chef, for one, because you don't talk back and you just work. Everything was cut to order. Like if you put sliced cucumbers on a plate, you had to slice the cucumbers to order. I mean, everything had to be done to order. We did duck confits. We did how to properly butcher, how to cook and cut vegetables. You know, we weren't allowed to use any peelers, so everything had to be carved like potatoes and carrots with a knife. And it was just the discipline of, you know, how you come in and work, how you organize the station, how you work clean. I mean, he caught a guy once putting a dirty towel over his shoulder. So the chef went into the dirty linen and tied all these towels together, the dirty towels together in a robe, and he wore it around the kitchen. Doesn't I look great? My robe of filthy towels. And he just humiliated this guy for 30 straight minutes. I mean, he stopped everything he was doing to take a half an hour to humiliate this guy. So obviously, that made quite an impression on me.
Yes.
And he was right. You know, you don't put dirty towels on you. I mean, it's gross.
Donald continued with culinary school while working in a handful of kitchens in San Francisco, prepping food at the Flying Saucer, spending days at a place called Scala's, and working brunch at a restaurant called The Elite. He wasn't the head chef there, but he worked the busiest shift of the week, cooking eggs to order.
So I've been 6 months into doing my own menu. Things are going great. People are loving it. I'm having a blast. It's me and one other cook. And we're doing like 300 brunches. I mean, this is back in the day where you just had to bust your ass. So one day, my friend, the other line cook, grandfather died, so he had to leave. So the chef's like, well, I'll come in and work. So the way the line was set up is I did all the eggs. He did the poached eggs, toasting of the bread, and a couple other things. But I did all the omelets to order, French, yellow, perfect omelets, you know, nice soft scrambled eggs, over easy, the whole bit. So he's like, well, I'm going to work the egg station. I said, man, you can't handle the egg station. And it's eggs and tickets, and you got to do both. And I was like, man, you can't handle that. I said, you need to come over here and toast bread and poach eggs. He goes, well, I'm the chef, and I'm working the station. So here it comes. Service starts. Tickets start to pour in. I mean, this line's no joke, man. Service starts to pour in, and there he goes, browning the omelets. I mean, just I'm like, man, you can't put color on them. He goes, well, that's what I was taught. I said, well, you were taught wrong. So anyway, he keeps getting worse. And then finally, I was like, man, I think I threw my spatula up against the wall. And I said, either get off my station or I'm walking. And he didn't. So I'm like, I said, I'll be out back smoking a cigarette if you change your mind. So in the middle of the rush, all hell's breaking loose. I just went back there and sat on the milk crate and just watched, waited. 3 minutes later. Man, you got to come back. I said, you're getting off my station? He goes, fine. I was like, all right, I'll come back. Like I said, he really didn't want to work that station.
I love it.
I mean, the guy was going down in a ball of flames. There was no way he could get out of it. So, yeah, I worked there. Scala's another place called Dazi for a little bit. And then I got my intern at Bayona.
Oh, you came to New Orleans as an intern to work with Susan Spicer.
I was an intern at Susan in 95. And I did that for a year and a half to two, made it up to sous chef there, and then moved back to San Francisco to open Jardiniere with Tracy Desjardins, and was the opening sous chef slash purchaser buyer, which was an amazing experience and product. That was one of those kind of like Flying Saucer was to cooking techniques and how to be a real solid, perfect line cook. You know, what I learned at Jardiniere was, you know, for 2 months before it opened and then a few months into it, I went to all the farms, all the butchers, all the cheese shops. I mean, I'm buying caviar out the back door. I thought it was illegal the way they used to sell it. They come through the back door and give you a little marble mother of pearl spoon, taste every 10. But it all seemed so shady. I was like, this is legal, right? I mean, I feel like I'm breaking the law here, but I know I'm not. So anyway, I learned a lot about product and ordering and, you know, for a big house. You know, it's like 500-600 covers a day kind of place. And then I got an offer. I heard that that chef at the Elite, the place where that guy, chef, worked, heard he got fired.
About time.
This is my end. This could be my first chef job. I'm going to go in there. And I got my resume together, and I went in to the GM who was there when I cooked brunch. And, you know, I was really great with the GM and the owner. They loved me. And I went in, and I said, look, tell Tom, he was the owner at the time, I said, tell Tom that if he wants to do some real food here and do something, upgrade everything that goes on here and let me have my way, I'd love to be the chef here. I said, I won't be the chef here with this menu, but if he wants to make a change and take it up, let me know. So I think it was like that night he called and he said, man, I'd love to have you come in. I said, okay, well, just let's make sure we're really clear what we're talking about here. I'm going to throw all the food in the trash and start over. So just so we're clear.
Uh-huh.
And I want to write anything I want to do. I need 100% carte blanche. And he agreed to it. And he said, well, I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to fight on your hands because some of those people love those dishes. And I forgot which one it was. It was some like fried fish with crab meat sauce all over it. And I was like, I'll do something like that. And that's it. So I went in on a Sunday, and the guy that I cooked brunch with was still there. So, and we were still good friends. So I went in, I watched service, and it was horrible what those cooks were producing. I mean, just horrible. So at the end of the night, I said, all right, guys, throw everything in the trash. And he looked at me like I was crazy. I said, no, everything, just dump it. So me and Kevin and I picked a couple guys out of that staff that I thought would work out and fired the rest. Went in the next morning and started a whole new menu for dinner that day.
That day.
I mean, I just came up with a good, concise menu. And so I did that for, a year and a half.
Did they come cry about the fish with the crab meat cream sauce and where was that?
Yeah. I was like, no, we don't do that anymore. I mean, you know, I was 27 years old at the time. God, I was just, rough.
So things went really good at the Elite.
Things went
for
good,
the 27-year-old Donald Link.
Got great write-ups. People loved the food. I mean, for any one person that hated that I took their blacking redfish off, you know, there's 100 more that loved the food. And then I started arguing with the GM over dumb stuff like, you know, he goes, you know, no one will ever be able to replace you. I'm like, well, how's that my problem?
Yeah. I mean, James Beard Award-winning chef at all the restaurants.
I even wanted to buy that restaurant. So anyway, they brought me to another place. The owner there was like, we have this opportunity in Palo Alto. And this is where I learned a very valuable lesson on partnerships and money. If you look at the phases of the career where I learned the most, like, obviously, I learned cooking as a kid, you know, but the basis of it. But now we get to partnerships and business, you know. So anyway, we go to this place, and it's in Palo Alto, and the deal was we'll give you a third ownership, and all you have to do is repay out of profits 100 or 300 grand over time. You pay this back, and you'll own a third. I'm like, great, sounds good. So I start writing the menu, I get a chance to start over, do my own thing. And I wasn't prepared for the onslaught that was coming when we opened. And I never got my contract. I was so busy trying to open the restaurant. My wife was pregnant with our first kid, Cassidy. And it was just this timing thing where we were basically changing the dates to open from when her birth was. I mean, I have a picture of me and her at a week old in my chef coat and boxes all over the floor pointing like, dude. It's like, all right, here, take her. I'm going to go back to work. But I never did get that contract. And we opened the doors up the first night, man, lines out the door. I didn't realize I was that popular until I opened that restaurant.
They followed you right up to Palo Alto.
They followed me all the way up there, and it was busy every night, and the place was packed. Everything was going well. And then I finally get the contract, and I don't get any ownership. I said, well, I thought, you know, I was getting a third. And they're like, you know, it was still a third, but now the price was like, you know, $1.5 million or something. So I said, well, I'm out. You know, I'm going to stay here another 3 or 4 months to give you time to turn this thing over to something else. I said, but I have to leave. You know, it was kind of me, but I didn't.
Yeah, the other
I was in no position to not be paid either.
Okay, yeah, because now you're a daddy, but the pre-daddy Donald would have gone outside and sat on the milk crate and smoked a cigarette until they reconsidered.
Well, that was an issue of my food getting messed up, and I didn't want to see it.
Yeah. Now you had your name tied to it all.
So anyway, it didn't work out. You know, people were stealing. I mean, talk about Coke. Everyone in there was ripping lines all over the place. I mean, it was just it was hard to contain. It was, yeah. I mean, the food was really good. And then I just had to start getting someone else in there and telling them, look, you just do your stuff. I'm leaving. And that's when I started coming to New Orleans.
Speaking with Donald Link, executive chef at Herb Saint and owner of the Link Restaurant Group. After a short break, we'll be back to hear what lured Donald back to Louisiana. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. We've been talking with Donald Link, award-winning chef, author, and savvy businessman.
The following is a true story. Only the names have been changed to protect the guilty.
Donald grew up in southwestern Louisiana's Calcasieu Parish, then moved to California and excelled in the kitchens of San Francisco. He'd been working for other people, but eventually decided to work for himself.
Well, first I started looking around California. You know, there were a lot of jobs paying six figures that were clipboard chef jobs, you know, show the Latinos how to make crab cakes and Caesar salad kind of job. Didn't want that. You know, that was not me. I didn't want that in my life. So then I met with my father-in-law, and he was like, what will it take to get you guys and my granddaughter back to New Orleans? I said, well, I could use some help getting my own restaurant open. And I came here looking at restaurant spaces, ran into Susan, and started talking. She said, well, Kenny and I were thinking about doing the restaurant. And I'm like, well, I'm here looking at restaurants too. And that's when we decided to do it together with, you know, her name here, me coming in from out of town again. And, you know, there was a story there from me working for her. You know, it opened up as a really good partnership. And, I mean, God, what we opened that for now compared then, what it would cost now. It's a staggering difference. Yeah. But it was a great opening, you know. I mean, I love Susan. I mean, Susan was a great mentor of mine at Bayona. She's the one that probably got me calmed down the most because I was kind of a hothead. I think my nickname was Hotshot or something when I worked over there.
In the year 2000, Donald opened Herb Saint in partnership with Chef Susan Spicer. Herb Saint quickly became a favorite of critics and customers alike. By 2007, Donald was named James Beard's Best Chef of the South and was on his way to building an empire. He partnered with Chef Steven Strajewski to create Koshan, which immediately garnered more Beard recognition. And this past spring, their newest restaurant, Pesh, was named Best New Restaurant in America, and their chef partner, Ryan Pruitt, received Best Chef of the South.
The staff we have now are just night and day from what we started with. And it was rough in the beginning. You know, I did everything. I mean, I worked 8 in the morning to 2 in the morning. I mean, every day. I mean, I did the prep, the expo. I cooked the line. I mean, I washed dishes. I think the key element, I'll never forget the having the conversation with my wife when I said I wanted to open a second restaurant. And she's like, why?
I said, see you enough already.
I said, I think I'll have more time. And she goes, that's insane. That thinking doesn't work. I'm like, well, this is the way I look at it. I want to open Koshan. And Koshan was, for one, I think Steve is awesome, obviously. And I knew it away. And he was a grill cook at Herb Saint. And I'm like, man, that guy's got talent. So I make him a sous chef. obviously he's a great sous chef. I'm like, start thinking, you know, I've been slaving away in his kitchen for years and years. Can I do this when I'm 60 or 50? I mean, it's, I'm not going to want to do this 30 years from now. I mean, there's got to be a plan, and I don't want to lose Steve. Somebody with that much talent is going to need to move up. There's an opportunity there for Koshan was to, you know, bring the food of my childhood into a restaurant and bring in Steven as a partner. Because, you know, I can't be the chef at every restaurant. I can't be in every kitchen all day long. In my opinion, what it takes to be a chef of one restaurant is you got to be there all the time and you've got to be in charge and there's got to be a singular point of accountability. And Steve was talented, man. He's a great cook. He can run a kitchen. Because being a good chef is not just being a good cook. I mean, you got to be able to lead people. And it's a personality style and a culture as a restaurant that was very important to me. You know, when I moved to New Orleans, you know, one of my biggest goals in a restaurant was I want to own a place that if I worked there, I'd want to go every day and enjoy the people I stand next to every day. You know, I worked in a lot of kitchens where it wasn't like that. People, like, stabbed each other in the back and bitched about each other, and it was just somebody's over there bitching about somebody. And it's like, I don't, you know, I never wanted any of that, and we don't have that. I'd be more apt to fire someone on the spot for complaining about something than I would if they were in the back smoking crack. I mean, well, I'd rather catch someone ripping a line than bitching about another employee. I mean, to me, that's poison and that's the worst thing you could do. I was fortunate enough to be able to get people on the same page, and that's just kind of kept growing to where, you know, you get new managers and new cooks and new chefs, and they love what we do and how we run a business. You know, it's the way we handle our food, you know, the way we work with local farms. People like that, you know, getting whole animals, you know, letting cooks rotate through making terrines and butchering. And being a line cook can get old after a while. You know, you got this, you're cooking the same food every night, you know, with the addition of a few specials. But to be able to move around and see other things and to work at a place where you can be proud of the food you're putting out and the person next to you is pushing you instead of you carrying them is very important. I think that if it's not fair to bring someone in that can't keep up with the rest of the line, and that's where you kind of lose that culture. But, the people that are management across the board and everybody down to the wait staff, the dishwashers, I mean, the whole staff, I think, is just really a good unit. I mean, there's just a good vibe in the group, and I think that is what carries out to the floor, which then turns into, I guess, James Beard Awards. I mean, it's kind of like a courtship in a way. Partnerships are very important. I mean, they're like marriages. You have to know that you're going to be spending time with these people, and they're good or bad. And partnerships are really tested more when things are when you don't agree.
I was going to ask you about that. How do you settle things when you don't agree?
Oh, we always agree.
Okay, sure, Donald.
But, you know, like I said, that's part of the courtship. You know, you just find your way through it. And it's basically a matter of, like, when you go, hey, I got an idea. Let's talk about it. And that's how we approach things. It's like, what do you think about this? Well, I don't know. Maybe if we did this instead. And there's just always a process. And I can't say that there's never been an impasse on some things. But, you know, you get to a point where, and they're very few and far between, but when we get to an impasse, like if we say Steve and I, for example, don't agree on something, mm-hmm. then it has to come down to another level of how important is it to you? Who does it mean more to at this point, and can you live with it? And then we move on.
But Donald's most prized pig, Koshan Butcher.
We used to have all our meetings on the sidewalk in front of Herb Saint, which I miss so much, having my meetings there. I have the original Performa numbers for Butcher, and it's an eighth of what we're doing now.
Wow.
And it just blew up, man. That place, I mean, we never in a million years thought it could do those kind of numbers. I mean, it's a beast.
So what's next on your plate, Chef?
I'm going to retire next month. You know, right now, I've always taken the summer to work on new dishes. I mean, that's always a time where you can experiment, try some new things, you know, try them at home. We try some at the restaurants. And then, you know, we're planning on moving into Nashville with Butcher. So that's our next.
Really?
Yeah. So far, man, the response has been great. I think Germantown's a great neighborhood. I mean, we spent a year and a half to 2 years just going to Nashville, looking at neighborhoods, and Germantown is, to me, is a lot like the Warehouse District. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, obviously I like the Warehouse District because that's where all the restaurants are. I just think over there is our spot for now. You know, I'm somewhat cautious and a little traumatized from my experience in Lafayette. So I'm being very careful with this butcher and, you know, making sure that we're very clear on what its concept is and how we're going to position it and who's going to run it. You know, going to Lafayette was weird because, you know, you're cooking their food, which is my food.
Right.
But everybody there has their own way to do it, and they don't understand that there's a restaurant that does it. You know, one of the things with Lafayette, I think we may have been too fine dining in that circumstance. Whereas, you know, I think Butcher is just a lot more approachable.
Totally.
It's food that everybody's familiar with, and it's done really well with the meats that we make, and everything's made in-house. And it's got a great fun vibe. You know, the key to restaurants is really combining your concept and making it make sense with each other. I mean, the space, the food, the style, all has to be together. If one of those things gets off, it's just that hidden thing that makes restaurants work or not work. Mm-hmm. It's really, unfortunately, not always about the food. Does someone walking in with a certain perception of what a restaurant is that met? Uh-huh. Is that expectation level met when they walk in or exceeded? Or is it, well, this isn't what I thought it was going to be? And that's what makes or breaks restaurants. We just have to really make sure that we're tight with it and on point, because it's hard leaving town. You know, it's a different beast altogether. I mean, Lafayette
was
only
a long way away. Lafayette was just a day trip and back.
Yeah, a long day trip. But but I love Nashville. You know, Nashville's got a great feel. A year ago, we were like, man, we're going to open 10 butchers. And now we're like, we're just going to open one and see how that goes.
Mm-hmm. That's Chef Donald Link, restaurateur, author, and outspoken Cajun. For more information about Donald's books or restaurants, visit linkrestaurantgroup.com or our website on itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. What's the most important tool in the kitchen? Stay tuned, and we'll explore that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What's the most important tool in your kitchen? Ask any chef, and they'll tell you it's your knife. That's the one thing you can't do without. If you only have one good knife, make it a chef's knife. Those are the ones with the slightly curved blade that facilitates chopping. Size is a personal choice, so hold the knife in your hand to see what feels best. 6, 8, or 10 inches. The proper way to hold a knife is by the handle, grasping it like you're about to shake hands. Don't place your index finger along the top of the blade when cutting. That will make for a wobbly knife that's easy to cut yourself with. The knife should be well balanced in your hand and have a full tang. That means the metal extends from the knife's tip to the very end of the handle. Some people think ceramic is the best choice for a sharp knife, but their fragility frightens me. For hundreds of years, carbon steel was the choice of chefs, but it rusts and is reactive to eggs, onions, and acidic food. So today, I think the best answer is high-carbon stainless. The high carbon allows the knife to hold its edge and sharpen easily, and the stainless makes it completely non-reactive. And please, don't put those knives in the dishwasher. Nothing ruins a fine knife like that. Treat your knives like the treasures they are, and your grandchildren will be happy to inherit them one day. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. Public radio contributor Ian McNulty covers the restaurant scene for the New Orleans Advocate.
That makes him perfect for always knowing where to go next. Ian, where are we going today?
One of the things I learned fast exploring Louisiana was that these places that look like dead ends on the map are really just the jumping off points for the real adventure that awaits out in the wetlands and the marsh and out in the Gulf of Louisiana, where so much of the sportsman's culture and the food culture of our state happens. And for me, that makes these places really fascinating destinations for quick day trips. Even though they're a little, shall we say, unconventional. I mean, you're not going to explore a quaint little town with gift shops at these places. You know, these are
it's not Cape Cod.
Exactly. Yeah, these are hardworking fishing villages, and you know, that end of the road urge, though, that people have. This can really satisfy that if you're attuned to the charms of the Louisiana landscape and culture, which of course all revolve around water and food and outdoors. So today we're going to Cocodrie.
Okay.
And to get to Cocodrie, you have to go through Chauvin. And all of this is along a linear path that follows Highway 56 out of Houma, out of that tangle of bayous and highways that kind of converge in Houma and then, you know, branch out spiderweb-like towards the Gulf. One place that you have to stop at is called the Cecil Laperouse Grocery, also known as Cecil's by everybody around there.
Okay.
This is a Bayou general store. They stock everything from cast iron skillets to plumbing fixtures. It's the only game in town around that area for anything you might need. It's not a restaurant, but it's a great place to go in the back. There's like sort of a grotto leading down to the bayou with a fuel dock and a bait dock and these swings. So you can get yourself a cold drink and have a little rest there from the road and watch the bayou and the boats go by. Great way to start or end this day trip. Along the way, there's Sportsman's Paradise, which is a very aptly named restaurant. It's a very small restaurant, great fried seafood. Going down a little further, you're going to hit the place at the very end of the road where everything ends sort of ingloriously with a boat launch and a dumpster and a seafood processing plant. And then Boudreaux's. This is a marina called Boudreaux's. And it's looks a little fortified from the street, let's say. You know, it's built to withstand some heavy weather down there.
Yeah.
Don't let that dissuade you from going. You walk upstairs. Everything's a floor up, elevated. And you find this big dining room and bar with windows overlooking the open marsh. And it's a beautiful view of fishing boats doing their thing, pelicans swooping down doing their thing. And then when you start doing your thing, which is sitting down for your meal, you're going to find really fresh, really good seafood. Sort of the irony of places like this is they, you know, they are at the end of the road. Everything comes to them through this really long supply chain. I mean, every bottle of ketchup and every ounce of Coke that this place goes through has to be shipped in from Houma, which was shipped in from somewhere else. So it's the end of this long supply chain. But what really matters, the seafood you're there to eat, that stuff came from right down the way, from the seafood dock that might be just next door or the boat that just pulled in. It's sort of a think of like a typical Louisiana family seafood restaurant kind of a menu. So that's Boudreaux's Marina at the end of the line there. And, you know, as you're working your way back up, I mean, you're taking your time with this, hopefully, but there's a number of really neat spots. There's Boo's, a great little spot for fried things to take out if you're going to make yourself a little bayou side picnic, let's say, if you're going to go fishing off the side of the road. And along the same lines, Mama D's. This is a walk-up snowball stand with Mexican food and, like, snacks, you know, hot dogs and nachos and stuff. So you're having, like, some guilty pleasure food and overlooking the bayou. And again, a good spot to get some takeout to take with you for maybe your little bayou side fishing trip.
What fun. Thank you so much for taking us on that little mini vacation, Ian.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, the end of the road, as we say, it's the start of a lot of things.
Ian McNulty, our Louisiana Eats roving reporter. Anyone who lives in New Orleans is likely to be familiar with the dat dog phenomena. New Orleans was never known as a hot dog town, but Skip Murray changed all that. The native New Orleanian and self-described hot dog guy opened the first dat dog in a shed on Ferret Street in 2011. Once he and his partners moved the dog to a larger space across the street, the restaurant exploded in popularity and size.
There are Dat Dogs now on Magazine and on Frenchman Street, spreading that big hot dog smile from one end of the city to the other. While the business grew quickly in the last 3 years, Skip Murray's creative ambition doesn't end there. Recently, we sat down with Skip to talk about his newest venture. He discussed the importance of having a clear concept at the start and maintaining that concept throughout the expansion process.
Well, first of all, simplicity is the key to happiness and success. The more moving parts you have, the more complicated it gets. And when you have that, you're no longer the hot dog guy. You're worried about all the things that go bump in the night. So the concept was so simple to do. It was simple, but it wasn't easy. Okay. It was not easy. So it would be a misnomer to say, oh yeah, it looks really easy. It looks easy, but it's mainly simple. And then you have to bring it together. You take the plate design and you apply it to this dog, and then you create different flavors with it. Some work better than others. It was really important that, because I was born and raised here, that it had New Orleans and Europe. And we think of ourselves as kind of this American European city anyway. So I tried to combine those together, knowing that it still had to stay simple. So the heart and soul of it is still the simplicity of, we want to turn out the best dog we can do. In expanding, you know, the thing I loved about New Orleans was that we won't let anybody walk by us without, certainly it's always, hey, how you doing, how you doing, how you doing, you know, lots of that. But there's also that idea that, you know, how you doing, and how's your mama doing, and how's your brother doing, and how are they doing, let me tell you about my mama. And so there is that I remember from so long ago, and that it exists today also, that we're approachable. And the idea behind it is that not only are you important, but we're going to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, expanding out, we're on number three now, and now it kind of legitimizes the business. And I didn't, it's a strange thing, because I'd heard that once from someone I admired in a business. He said, I didn't want to do something because it would legitimize my business. Now, I know we're legitimate business, but the idea that we're going to duplicate, My feeling is how do you retain a heart and soul to a business if you expand it? And I don't have that answer yet. I don't know where that goes. Today we're a company of alphabet. We have CEOs, COOs, CFOs, UFOs, USOs, and OOs.
So you're the UFO. I already knew that. That's your official title.
So by having said that, you know, where's the heart and soul in that? And the thing is I'm not playing it down. I'm not singing praises. I don't know where that goes.
Well, what I do know is that you successfully conceptualized and created a brand. You've got a good, solid menu. It's working.
Dat Dog is the a place for European sausage and wieners and Lachine, Louisiana, with our sausages, alligator crawfish. And so to bolt on anything, to expand the menu on that would be very counterproductive because, for instance, oftentimes I think companies will look at what they're doing well, and then as they get larger and larger, new ideas come on board and you start to become something else, and therefore your thrust changes because your focus changes. I mean, the most important aspects of this are quality of product, quality of service, and the staff make that happen, because it was never intended to be a place to buy a hot dog and a beer. It had to have that something else. So I think that's been done. There's no revisiting that. I personally think that any changes to Dat Dog would be bolt-ons, and there would be no reason for it.
Keeping the importance of simplicity in mind, Skip Murray is now opening a new restaurant in New Orleans that combines all the best aspects of Dat Dog, but is an entirely new concept. What's he calling his new restaurant? Once you hear it, I'm sure you'll agree it's an obvious choice.
The place is going to be called Dis and Dat.
Dis and Dat.
Yeah.
Dis so and that's Dat. That's the big reveal.
That's the big reveal. Okay. Because, you know, we do Dis Burger and Dat Dog. Okay. That's the idea. It will have the feel of Dat Dog. It will have that thing that we do that you can't put into a business plan. It has to be very personal. You know, it will be friendly. It has to be friendly. Being in New Orleans, it will always feel as though that it's a part of New Orleans, maybe with a little bit of a European twist to it in the sense of what it looks like at al fresco dining and things. But we do that here anyway, so it's not me reinventing the wheel on that. But I think you should always have that part and parcel to it.
How do you distinguish Dis and Dat from that you've done before?
I'm going to do 6 variations on burgers, okay?
Okay.
8-ounce burger, grilled, glazed. It will be an onion bun from the same Cajun elves that bake our bread 12 miles outside of Laplace. This is a burger that your mama wish she had, okay? All right, that's it. 8-ounce burger, grilled, okay? I always glaze it. This black lady I met a very long time ago gave me her secret glaze. That glaze goes with it, okay? Chiffonade, which is spring lettuce, and you roll and then it's thin sliced. That's mm-hmm. part and parcel. Fan Roma tomatoes, thin sliced red onion, real cheese. When I left this country and I went to Europe, we had 2 kinds of cheeses. We had yellow cheese and white cheese. And all of a sudden, I'm in this place where yellow and cheese is not even in the top 10, okay? Mm-hmm. And plastic wrap doesn't work anywhere. And I know as Americans, we love cheese goo. We do. I prefer that we do real cheese. So it'll be shredded sharp cheddar cheese, beef from New York.
Okay.
English cheese would be really, really good too. What else? Bacon.
Uh-huh.
Bacon will work.
So, Skip, now we know the name of your new brainstorm.
Yeah, that's it.
Dis and Dat.
Brainstorm, yeah.
So where are we going to find you in this brainstorm?
The address is 2540 Bank Street in Mid-City. I call us on the best side of banks, but it's a half a block down from the that Complete Medical Center Research yeah. Project, VA Hospital and whatnot.
And you back up to it right there, huh?
Right there on bank. Filled with oak trees leading into the medical complex. I don't think it could get any better. I wasn't as familiar with Mid-City as I was after Katrina, okay? And now Mid-City to me is a place I want to go to. And I think that Mid-City is up and coming. It's got nothing to do with me. I think New Orleans is up and coming, and it has very little to do with me at all. But at the same time, I do love watching the changes, and I like the energy that other people bring to the city. And Mid-City has that. I met this – I was knocking on doors, and I asked this lady in Mid-City, do you like living in Mid-City? She didn't know me from Adam. So I said, do you like living in Mid-City? I love living – how long have you lived in Mid-City? She said, 20 years. I go, are you from New Orleans? No, I'm from L.A. I thought, well, okay, that's a twist on the tail. And so I said, well, you know, I'm the hot dog guy, blah, blah, because she asked me as to why I was knocking on her door. And I said, dat dog. And she said, oh, got very enthused, started doing that dat dog dance. I don't know why that happens. But anyway, so, you know, I told her that I was thinking about this. And she said, oh, you got to do it here because we in Mid-City love businesses coming to Mid-City. And we love the whole – and it's a neighborhood, isn't it? It is. It's its own unique neighborhood,
it
just like Uptown
is
a neighborhood.
Now, this is really upping the ante. I think what I hear you telling me is that you are setting out – to do for the burger what you did for the dog?
I'm going to do the best I can do, okay? That's my misnomer on this. I believe we could turn out the best I can do. Hopefully that'll be appreciated.
So it's going to be simple,
it's simple.
Beautiful.
Simple's good.
Consistently executed.
I hope so.
And if you're really longing for some encased meats, you'll have them there too.
Of course. Of course. You can't be the hot dog guy. Okay, you know what? I could be the burger dog guy, you know. The burger dog guy. Okay. Again, I only really have one style, and that style is I have to like what I'm doing. It has to be fun. We have to be personal. And everybody and their brother is important to me. And we turn out the best we can do.
Well, Skip, I am so excited that you decided to come and share your big reveal with us, the latest brainstorm in Skip Murray's life, Dis and Dat.
Yeah, burger and dog joint.
So that's we'll be us. Seeing you over by Dis and by Dat.
I hope so.
Thanks, Skip.
Thanks, now.
That's Skip Murray of Dat Dog and now Dis and Dat. To learn more about Skip and the Dat Dog phenomena, you can find a link to our 2011 interview with him on itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Nothing goes better with a hot dog or burger than French fries. But for food writer Scott Gold, depending on the quality, this side dish can make or break a meal. Scott's here to discuss the concept of slash fries and how he learned to make Belgian-style frites with the help of a food truck French fry guru.
Like most decent, God-fearing, patriotic Americans, I have a pure and abiding love of potatoes deep-fried in the French fashion. I wouldn't want to live in a world where I couldn't pair my burger, club sandwich, hot dog, or milkshake with a beautifully golden pile of hot, salty, crispy fried potatoes. But sadly, it seems as though fries in this great country of ours are so often saddled with second billing. Always a bridesmaid, never a bride. Few things are more resoundingly disappointing than getting a decent sandwich, steak, or other entree with a melancholy side order of greasy, flaccid, under-seasoned fries, or potatoes left in the oil or under a heat lamp so long they're essentially cremated and deserve to be placed in a ceremonial urn rather than actually consumed. This is what's known as the W/fry phenomenon, as in something that appears in a menu W/fries, or slash fries for short. Slash fries should be regarded with a healthy amount of suspicion, since the kind of person writing a menu who can't be bothered enough to add an additional two characters is probably not overly concerned with getting those fries just right. It's a menu, not Twitter. There's no character count. In this case, I usually just go with chips. It's a safer bet. I wasn't always so persnickety about my fries, mostly because I didn't fully know what distinguished a passable fry from a truly outstanding one. Enter Zeph Courtney. In my personal history of French fried potatoes, the man is the Yoda to my whiny Luke Skywalker. He also coined the term slash fries, for which I think he should receive a significant food journalism award. Several years ago, Zeph and his wife, my friend Liz, started their own food truck and catering business called Snap, which provided thoughtfully executed Chicago-style hot dogs, flame-grilled burgers, and of course, fries. When I first tasted their thick-cut Belgian-style frites, I knew they were something special, but it wasn't until months later, when I actually joined their kitchen crew for a spell, that I'd actually understand why these potatoes soared so high above their cowardly, greasy brethren. Kitchen magic isn't sorcery so much as it is science, and Jedi Fry Master Zeph would teach me as much in the sweltering corner of a food truck that housed the deep fryers. "What I'm doing here is no mystery," he told me. "People have known how to do this for years, and now I'm going to show you how to do it too." Here's the deal. You start with good potatoes. Burbank russets are particularly suitable for frying. Then you slice them, which Zeph did with a heavy-duty stainless steel pull slicer fitted with a quarter-inch grate. This size falls somewhere between standard American fries, slightly bigger than shoestring, think McDonald's size, and steak fries, a Goldilocks happy medium of French fry styles. The slicer would deposit the potatoes into a tankard of clean, fresh water, where they'd soak for at least 1 hour or even overnight. This step is crucial because it leaches out starch from the potatoes, which helps them crisp up nicely when fried. After drying thoroughly, you don't want that water to hit the hot oil and send you screaming to the burn unit, they get a nice bath in peanut oil heated to 325 degrees for 10 minutes. Then they take a little nap, also known as resting, for at least 20 minutes, another crucial step. This lets the inside of the potato achieve a nice, fluffy texture. Then a second fry at 400 degrees for a quick 2 minutes should get them to that lovely deep golden color and crisp exterior that represents the platonic fried eel. Toss them with a generous helping of sea salt and serve hot with your condiment of choice. It wasn't long before I went from French fry Padawan to a bona fide Jedi Knight of fried frites, and after that, there was no looking back. Fortunately, the French fry scene has been changing in wonderful ways in recent years down here, and fried potato connoisseurs can find everything from Canadian-style poutine featuring hot fries smothered in cheese curds and rich roast beef debris gravy, to fries topped with pulled pork, grilled scallions, and bechamel sauce, and of course, authentic Belgian street frites, among many others that will make you reconsider ever ordering slash fries again. Or, to paraphrase Judge Reinhold's character from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, "I will eat no fries before their time."
That was food writer and native New Orleanian Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we go tailgating with Taylor Mathias.
I get the question all the time of, oh, what's the best tailgate? I can't just say one because everyone is great for different reasons, but eating and spending a game day at LSU is definitely in my top five.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh.
and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.